This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
This episode is brought to you by Purina and their certified therapy dogs like Hanley. Say hi, Hanley! Hanley is one of 30 therapy dogs Purina has helped get certified to support kids struggling with their mental health. Purina employees are volunteering their time and family pets like Hanley to help make pet therapy more accessible to patients, students, and kids like me. Learn more about Purina's pet therapy program at purina.com/mentalhealth.
Hello and welcome to Out With Me, Susie Ruffle. This is Series 8, Episode 3. Good morning. Well, I'm saying good morning. You might be listening to this in the afternoon, the evening, I don't know. But for me, it is currently 6:45 on Saturday morning. I have crept upstairs with a cup of tea whilst my wife and my daughter sleep downstairs. Who knows for how much longer. To say hello and to do the intro to this brilliant interview that I've got for you today, because I'm off to Ireland today. I don't know how much you care, but you might want to know what I'm up to. I'm getting up early so I can go to Ireland. I'm going to Belfast today to do a show and then over to Dublin tomorrow. I'm taking my mum with me, but by the time you hear this, all of that will have happened and hopefully I will have had lovely shows, my first ever tour shows in Ireland, so I'm very much looking forward to that. But if my voice is a little croaky, that's why I've not long been up. I've got a fantastic episode for you today. I'm really excited to share it. Emmett de Monterey, I loved his book and I've fallen in love with him a bit. I just think he's brilliant. And I urge you all to go and buy a copy and read his book and hear his story. So interesting, so brilliant, and such a kind, lovely man. But we're going to get to that shortly. As ever, I have some listener emails to share with you. And also, wow, so many of you got in touch after Tig Notaro's episode last week. Lots of people on my Instagram, lots of people on here. Here being my emails, people clearly love Tig, and why wouldn't you? She's amazing. So if you haven't listened to that episode yet, maybe you're someone that's not massively into comedy and you're more into podcasts, and that's how you know about me. Tig Notaro is an enormously successful stand-up. I think she's absolutely brilliant, has been nominated for Emmys and Grammys, just brilliant. So if you haven't listened to last week's episode, have a listen to it. But this week's episode, it's a real corker. I'm really proud of it and I can't wait to share it with you. But first, as I say, let me share some listener emails. I do sound a little bit like I'm doing late night radio, don't I, with my voice? Okay, let's start with this one. Hi, Susie. I came across your Out podcast earlier this year. A latecomer, I know. And I've been catching up rapidly. I'm now on season 5. Thank you so much for helping our community feel so represented and seen. You're doing really important barrier removal work, so keep going. I've never heard that before, but I like it. I'll take it. Thank you. I decided to write in because I felt that the older LGBTQIA plus voice needed more representation. I couldn't agree more. Thank you for being that for me. My story isn't unique. I came out to myself at the age of 19 in 1985 after years of pining against and crushing on girls. From the age of 9, when I kissed a friend and felt very confused about it. Later, as a teenager, I had a huge crush on Barbara Streisand. Yentl was epic. When I came out to my parents 2 years later, my mum, who'd been my rock and really my only parent, as my dad worked abroad most of my childhood, rejected me and told me it was the worst thing I could have told her. It broke me and created a huge sense of shame in me that I carried around for many years, resulting in massive abandonment issues. It wasn't until I hit my 30s and started to, with the help of the therapist, shed the shame that I started to feel immense pride at being a lesbian. I had years of therapy to disentangle myself from my tendency to people please as a result of coming out, and my relationship with my mum is now healed to the point where I'm married to a woman, a wonderful woman in fact, and have a wonderful 30-year-old daughter and 2 grown-up stepchildren, and she, my mum, is involved in all of that. My story doesn't end there though. Last year, at the grand old age of 56, I came out as non-binary. All my life, I've struggled with my outward appearance as I felt I never fitted in. I wasn't femme, but I wasn't butch. Sometimes I describe myself as soft butch, but this never really felt right either. It was harder as I got older as well, and I often joked with my wife that I dressed like a 12-year-old boy. But my professional life was even more tricky. It's hard to be taken seriously when you don't fit the stereotypes played out in meetings and in boardrooms. I work in a leadership role in the health service, where there is still, I'm afraid, a lot of prejudiced attitudes. I never had the language to explain to myself or anyone else, and often was misgendered. Now I have the term non-binary. I feel freer to be me, to dress in a way that I choose, and to let people around me deal with their own biases and prejudices. I still do have gender dysphoria, and I've struggled with my body shape, but I'm slowly making steps to overcome this and move forward on my healing journey. Sorry this is so long, but I wanted you to know that having this podcast, as well as finding like-minded friends through the work that I do around EDI, has made a massive impact on me. You have lifted me from a dark place to a lighter one, and I know this is true for many of your listeners. Never underestimate how impactful you are by doing this work. Thank you. Thank you so much for getting in touch with me and for saying those kind things about the podcast. And you're so right, there is a real lack of older LGBTQIA plus voices in the podcast. So please do get in touch. I love hearing from everyone from all parts of our community. And thank you so much for not only sharing your story with me, but sharing so many of your feelings as well. I really appreciate it. And the kind words about the podcast, as I'm sure you know, really mean a lot. Okay, I've got one more email to share, and then we've got Emmett's excellent episode. Dear Susie, big fan of the podcast and your stand-up. I also love Big Kick Energy with Maisie. That's my podcast about women's football. I've really got back into the women's game because of it, so thank you for that. I'm getting in touch to thank you for this podcast, though. It's so refreshing to hear so many queer stories that have happy endings. Like you, I grew up under Section 28. And because of that, and a general acceptable homophobia that was around at the time, I stayed in the closet much longer than I wanted to. If people like you and Steph McGovern and Jem Brister and last week's guest Tig Notaro and some of our awesome lionesses had been around when I was growing up, I think I would have accepted myself a lot quicker and been a lot happier. But I am so happy for young gay women now coming out. How bloody awesome to feel less alone. I can't wait to see your stand-up show in a few weeks. Lots of love, Harriet. Thank you, Harriet. I really appreciate you getting in touch to say that. I think that a lot. Do you know, I was at the Attitude Awards this week where I was chatting to Steph McGovern, who is just brilliant. I just love her. She's great. And we were saying about the representation, and we were talking about the lionesses specifically, but then lots of different queer people in the room. And we were both saying, oh, imagine if we'd seen women like this when we were growing up. It would have been so brilliant. So I'm so pleased for young women now. And, you know, it's never too late for that representation, is it? Thank you, Harriet, for getting in touch, and come say hi at my tour show in a couple of weeks. Okay, let us get on with today's conversation. It is with the brilliant Emmett de Monterey. I hope that you love this as much as I did. Go and buy his book. It's brilliant. So, if you are a regular listener to this podcast, you will know that I'm very into my books. I've always got a couple on the go, and I love just falling into another world. And during my family holiday this year, today's guest's memoir was my companion, and let me tell you, I could not put it down. Go The Way Your Blood Beats, a memoir, is Emmett de Monterey's first book, and it's his story. Growing up in the 1980s in South London with cerebral palsy, Emmett was preyed over, abused in the street, totally unsupported by mainstream schooling, and warned at his sixth form college that if the rumours that he is gay are true, it's likely that he'd be expelled. It sounds, and it is, the book is enormously moving and some of it is upsetting, but also it really shines a light on a story that we don't often see. And it also, and I don't know how much Emmett will like this word, but there is an inspiration to it about being unapologetically, authentically yourself. And I think lots of people listening will understand that feeling and will hold on to that. It's insightful, unflinchingly honest, and beautifully written. It's about one man's fight to be seen. And I'm thrilled to talk to him today. Hello, Emmett.
Oh, hello, Susie. I feel a bit moved by that. Oh. So I'll just gather myself.
Oh, that's very nice. I told you, I messaged you afterwards and said how much I loved the book. I think it's a story that you sort of might think you know if you have friends that are queer or friends that are disabled, or is disabled the right word to use?
Yeah, for me
it is. For you,
yeah.
Yes. Okay, I would like prefer to check. But having such a unapologetically honest sort of telescope into your world, I found enormously moving.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to hear.
What was the experience of writing it like, of writing a memoir? Because you're a psychologist?
Yeah, I'm a trained psychotherapist.
Psychotherapist, right, okay. So are you constantly having sort of two dialogues in your head of like, part of you's on the couch and part of you's sitting next to it?
A little bit.
Yeah.
But I'm not, you know, I always wanted to be a writer.
Right.
And as a disabled kid, mm-hmm. books were a very, really important means of travel.
Yes.
You know, they were a way for me to explore different, brighter, bigger worlds when my friends were outside playing. And, you know, so books were really important. And, you know, as the years went by, I had this kind of secret, private thing of, oh, I really want to write a book. I really want to write a book. And my husband, who we'll talk about more later, kept saying to me, like, you really should. You should just try. And I realised that really the story I had to start with was my own.
Yeah.
And then I found the Write Now competition.
Yes.
And I applied for it and got selected, which was really peculiar.
I don't think it's peculiar at all, because I implore my listeners, the listeners, our listeners today, to pick up the book, because I don't think it is surprising. You have a beautiful way with words, but you also really specifically set a scene. Like, I really felt like I knew your family home.
Oh, that's
like I feel like I know your mum.
I tried really hard to she's great, isn't
she? Yeah, she really is. She sounds like an absolute legend.
Yeah, she is. But I really tried hard to put people into that experience,
mm-hmm.
to give them the colours and the sounds and the smells.
Yeah.
And like you were saying, the emotional texture of it, the way it felt to be,
yes.
to feel so alienated and to be,
yes.
and to feel at moments incredibly alone. And going back to your earlier question, the experience of writing it, I hoped it would be really, really cathartic.
Mm.
And I hoped that when I came to the end, I'd kind of be able to put that stuff to bed. And in a way, I sort of have. But it also, you realise that it doesn't really fix anything.
Mm.
Even having your say and putting it out there, it just makes you think about it in a slightly different way.
Yes. I find it's slightly different, but I find often if you're sort of aiming towards something, or you're writing a thing and you need to get it finished, sort of part of your brain goes, and then when I've done that, everything will be great.
Yeah,
because I've done that thing that I meant to do. And then you do the thing and you sort of go, oh, I'm still me in this scenario.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm still me here. Now I've just got a book next to me. So I don't want to give away too much of the book, but also, you know, I want to share you with the audience. So let's start kind of in the first sort of part of the book, where when you're 18 months, is it that your parents realised there was something different?
Yeah, my mum has four other siblings.
Right.
And so, and she's the eldest. So mm-hmm. she kind of really brought them, you know, she helped to bring them up.
Mm.
And so she knew from seeing other babies move that something was wrong about me.
Right.
And obviously she didn't want to see it for quite a long time.
Yeah, of course.
And then she said to my dad, like, we have to go to the hospital because Emmett is not, you know, I wasn't crawling. I wasn't really, you know how babies, I mean, I know you've got a baby. You know how babies kind of explore their feet?
Yes,
And I wasn't doing any of that. And I was, and so she... And my dad didn't want to see it either, so
no.
he was like, no, he's fine, he's absolutely fine.
And they were
fine.
Quite young, weren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, they were very young, and this is going back a long time. This is kind of the late 70s. So culturally, we're in quite a different place now.
Yes, absolutely.
And they really didn't want to see what was going on. And then eventually my mum said, we're going, we have to see. And the consultant said, yeah, he's clearly got some neurological damage. That was the word they used then.
And I suppose when a parent would hear the word neurological damage, you would fear that would be a... Now, do correct me if I use the wrong terminology, because I try my best, but sometimes I get things wrong. But you would fear maybe that there would be an intellectual disability.
Yes,
or
absolutely.
Or, you know, something to do with how someone would grasp the world.
Absolutely.
In that respect. And was that a great
fear
for them?
You're absolutely right. That was that. I think that was their biggest fear, actually, more than the physical stuff. I think because obviously as a parent, you want your child to experience the world as fully and as as wonderfully as they can. And yeah, they were really concerned that that was also going to be a problem. And luckily it wasn't.
And was there a moment when... I suppose your mum must have realised that you were in there, you know, this version of you, the grown up version of you that I'm now opposite, but that you know, that there was, you were sharp, you know, in that respect.
The lovely thing was that the health visitor said, in common with a lot of people with cerebral palsy, when he starts talking, he'll never stop.
Yep.
And my mum laughs about that to this day. She's like, yeah, you're very talkative.
Yeah.
And you're very forthright. So
yes.
Yeah, you've never really been shy at putting yourself forward.
Is that a forthrightness? Who knows? Do you think that is something that was like there within you? Like intrinsic to who you are, or is it because you've always had to do that little bit of extra fighting?
I think you're exactly right, Susie. I think it's about the little bit of extra fighting.
Mm.
I've also been very conscious that I can't move in the way that my friends can, and
right.
I can't move in the way that other people in the world can. So I needed to make it attractive for people to want to sit next to me. So I needed to be funny, or I needed to be entertaining.
Yeah.
I'm not nearly as funny as you are. but
well, you only see me on good days. They're the only days that they record it.
But I needed to be attractive, and
yeah.
I wanted company, I wanted friends.
Of course.
So you don't want to be the person who's quiet. And also, in common with a lot of disabled people, I wanted to make people comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So I was never precious around the language that was used.
Yes.
And I was quite careful to laugh at myself, and so that people were laughing with me rather than at me.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Tried to make it quite an open dialogue, and I tried to make it like there was never anything that was off limits, and never anything for me. I know I can only speak for me,
of course,
but there was never anything that I wouldn't talk about, or that I wouldn't approach with people.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening to me talk, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now. Getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
This episode is brought to you by Purina and their certified therapy dogs like Hanley. Say hi, Hanley! Hanley is one of 30 therapy dogs Purina has helped get certified to support kids struggling with their mental health. Purina employees are volunteering their time and family pets like Hanley to help make pet therapy more accessible to patients, students, and kids like me. Learn more about Purina's pet therapy program at purina.com/mentalhealth.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
I think that's interesting as well, because obviously, you know, you're part of two communities, which is something we were talking about before. Well, we're all part of several communities, aren't we?
We are.
You know, I'm a comedian, I'm a lesbian, I'm a woman, I'm lots of things. But I think that's something that's come up before on the podcast, talking to other queer people, and that sort of taking ownership of laughter or just being funny to sort of mask something else about yourself.
Yeah.
I don't know. I wonder if you were doing that for both sides,
very much so, because I did. I think when I first became aware of my sexuality, I told myself that really what I was interested in was just I would sit on the bench in the playground, mm-hmm. looking at the boys playing football. Mm-hmm. You know, I spent a lot of break times sitting with the girls, which I loved.
Yes. And there's that friend that was became like your best
lovely
friend.
Lovely Joanna, who was just brilliant.
Are you still friends with her?
Yes. Yes,
that's
I am.
Nice.
And she's got a lovely wife and it's all worked out very well. So it's delightful.
Yeah, that's really nice.
But she used to sit with me and I used to watch the boys playing football And I used to think that it was only that I wanted to be like them.
Yeah.
I wanted to be physically able like they were. But as I got older, I suddenly started to think there's another component to this because I found them so... Yeah, I found that physicality so attractive.
Yeah.
And I suddenly was like, oh, shit.
Yeah, because I'm trying to think like... So that would have been sort of mid-80s?
Mm. Yeah, it was about kind of 1989. So it was the height of the... moral panic around AIDS and the whole, I mean, not dissimilar to the environment we're in now with the Conservative government attacking our rights left, right and centre.
Absolutely.
And stirring up anti-gay and anti-trans rhetoric.
Yes, 100%.
Feels quite familiar, doesn't
it? Yes, it does. It does.
But I remember kind of that horrible advert on the television, you know, the AIDS monolith of like, don't die of ignorance. So in common with a lot of gay people, my first understanding of my emerging sexuality was as a playground slur.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't want to be called a bender.
Yeah.
I would do anything to not be seen and called a bender. So I was actually, to my shame, I would pick on other people so that I wouldn't be considered the suspect. You know, it was a really peculiar, hothouse, quite hostile environment to grow up in.
And that feels, I mean, I think that feels quite... familiar to me, and I know indeed to other people that we've chatted to on this show, trying to make people look the other way so as not to look at you. And
exactly.
I think, you know, there were certainly times in my, when I was younger, where I would feel quite guilty for that. But I think everyone's just trying to survive, aren't they? I mean, school is, I mean, for some of us, fucking horrific. And
for me, it was pretty bad.
Yeah, like I hated it. I mean, horrific might be a bit strong, but I don't remember having a good day. It's survival. There's really there's no two ways about it. And so you moved around schools quite a lot.
Yeah.
And obviously your mum and dad knew very early on that intellectually there was nothing different about you. And they had to, there was a bit of a fight to get you into the sort of mainstream schooling system.
Mainstream school, exactly. I started school in a local disabled nursery, which was very friendly, very kind, very small.
But presumably that's just anyone that's other?
Yeah.
For want of a better word, is that right?
Exactly, yeah. It was just for anybody who had special needs
in
the local catchment area. And I had a really lovely time there and I felt very safe. But I also internalised something really weird. I kind of made it up in my own head that disability... I kind of thought that everybody had it and that it was something that you grew out of.
Oh, really?
It was really peculiar looking back on it. And I remember when I was writing the early parts of the book and I said to my mum, like, did I really think that or am I making it up in hindsight? And she's like, no, you had decided that this was just a phase that you were going to grow out of.
Yeah.
So that was...
Do you remember the moment when you realised that you weren't going to grow out of it?
Yeah, I write about it in the book. I started walking on something called a rollator, which is like a kind of a wheeled frame. So that was when I started. And then I graduated from that onto my first pair of baby sticks.
Mm-hmm.
And I was finding them very hard going and hard to navigate. And I was walking down the road to the sweet shop with my mum one day. It was a really sunny day. And I must have been about 5 or 6, maybe a bit younger. And I could see my shadow on the pavement and I could see her shadow in front of me. And her shadow obviously was very different to mine. Mm. But it was the first time I'd seen what I looked like moving through the world.
Right.
And I saw
I suppose in a mirror you're still.
Yeah, and you see yourself from, you know, in sections, don't you?
Yes.
So I kind of saw myself and I thought, oh my goodness, like I'm, and it was really a challenging moment because here I was with this person I loved more than all the world.
Mm.
You know, she was my mum, she was my family. And I realised that we were so different in that moment. Like she loved me and I loved her, but we were in the world in a very different way.
Yeah.
Which is quite a challenging thing to understand when you're so little.
Yeah.
You know,
and I wonder that your mum must have had that same moment at one point or another.
Yeah, she did.
When she was walking next to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it seems natural now to come onto the sort of section of the book where you're thinking that you were going to grow out of it. Then there was this sort of discussion that there could be a miracle for children that had cerebral palsy. And if you don't mind, for people that are listening that are like, I don't really have a context for what cerebral palsy is or what it does to your body or how it changes you.
Yeah, of course.
Could you sort of give us a little recap on sort of what it
means? Of course.
Means?
Cerebral palsy is an umbrella term for, it's basically a collection. I don't like this word, but they call it movement disorders.
Right.
And I don't consider it to be a disorder any longer.
No.
Although I did when I was, you know, I've gone on a bit of a journey with it. But it's a term that characterises a group of movement disorders that are primarily neurological. So basically, cerebral palsy usually arises through birth trauma or, you know, difficult deliveries.
Yes, one of my very good friends, that was the situation for her.
Not always, but it sometimes happens sort of post-utero, I believe, but it's usually as a result of brain injury.
And that could be something like, well, I know with my friend, it's because that she was starved of oxygen on her sort of way into the world.
Exactly the same.
Right, okay. And then there's sort of a few, well, there's, I think, several different types where your body can be sort of, and again, please correct me, but of like course. Sort of more sort of tight.
Yeah, that's what I've got. I've got a subset called spastic diplegia, which means that my muscles are kind of overwhelmed.
Yes.
Means I'm great in the cinema and scary movies. I'm jumping all over the place. People hate sitting behind me.
No, I'd quite like to go with you because I quite like jumping. So that's fine.
Jumping really far.
Fine. Okay, you might have to hold my hand, but other than that,
I'd
that's
be
fine.
Delighted.
and then there's other types that affect people in different ways.
Yes.
And so there was an American doctor, which I guess certainly at that time, I mean, still today to some degree, I guess, you know, you'll hear about these medical miracles that will change everything and will mean that you don't have these, that your body's different to how it is right now. And so how did that come about? Was it through a doctor?
Yeah, what was really strange about it, and I guess lucky, was that as I was growing taller, I was getting pulled into a crouching gait, and my consultant at Guy's said, you know, if this child gets much taller, then they'll be in a wheelchair, which obviously isn't a terrible thing at all.
No.
But we wanted to investigate alternatives.
So no, just to check, when you say a crouching gait, do you literally mean like bent forward?
Yes. I was essentially being pulled off my feet, because you know what we were saying earlier about tight muscles?
Yes.
My hamstrings were getting tighter and tighter and tighter.
They were just
pulling me down.
Right. Yes. Okay.
So they said if we don't intervene, then this child's going to be pulled off their feet. But what they were suggesting some quite haphazard medical interventions of like hamstring lengthening and hamstring cutting and stuff like that. And my parents, being the lovely, sensible, inquiring people that they are, said, this isn't good enough for our, you know, we're not allowing you to cut up our child on a whim. So unless you can come back to us with what the result of this is likely to be, then we're not going to do it. So
but it's sort of like, I don't want to use the word guinea pig, but was it like something that they hadn't done an awful lot of and it was a...
No, they'd done a lot of that kind of surgery in England.
Right.
But when we saw... We waited another year and we saw another consultant at Guy's, and she said, I don't know whether you'd be interested in this, but I've been reading about this new procedure that's being trialled in America, and I don't know whether you'd be interested in this, but I think Emmett's an ideal candidate for it. And I kind of didn't think I would get it.
Was it like sort of putting your name into a drawer?
Yeah,
in a
and
way,
I w- and
going,
I w-
this is the situation with Emmett. This
and
is
I was videotaped
like.
in a dingy room in my pants and my holy socks as a kind of 11-year-old, and I was just happy to be off school for the afternoon.
Yeah.
I just didn't really know what I was doing, but I knew that.
And what sort of age were you?
I was 11.
Yes,
I was 11, and I kind of thought, well, you know, I'm going to be off school. I might get McDonald's on the way home, so we'll just see what happens. And I was videotaped, and I was selected. And part of the agreement, if you like, with Guy's Hospital was that I would be a figurehead for this charity called One Small Step that would raise money to bring the technology that was being used in America back to Guy's Hospital, so that children in the UK with CP could benefit from the same process.
Yeah.
So it was really weird because not only was I selected to have this process, but I was also doing it in public.
Yeah, like a poster boy.
Yeah, doing it as part of a massive media campaign, which was really odd.
Because you have like cameras following you the whole time.
We had two, I was the subject of two BBC documentaries at the time. I got awarded something called, we would never use this word now, and I'm really glad that language changes and thinking changes, but I was awarded something called the Stars Organisation for Spastics Special Award,
right.
And that was on television, and it was really peculiar to the rhetoric around it was that it was a miracle and that you know, yeah, it was really, really weird to be up against that.
And that puts a lot of pressure on it working.
Yeah, and also it did work. The surgeon who did the surgery was absolutely baffled by the level of attention that I had and this huge media circus that I was part of. And, you know, he always said to me, we're talking about improvement, we're not talking about cure.
Right, yeah.
We will be able to have you walking into adulthood, which I still can and I still do. So in that sense, I'm incredibly grateful. But the things that are more complicated about it was it gave me the idea that I somehow needed to be fixed, you know, and at that age, I really wasn't able to inhabit my disabled identity with any degree of pride. And I'm glad to say that that's changed. And I've thought a lot about, you know, what we think about disabled people as a culture and the problem of internalised ableism.
Yeah.
And obviously it is, you know, the built environment and society's prejudice makes my life more difficult.
But of course.
But my disability is not the problem, really. It's the attitudes of some of those around me. And it's taken me a long time to get to that point.
The world in which you inhabit that's been made by people that don't, you know, that have not considered someone that isn't like them.
Yes, exactly.
And so you went to America and it did work because
it absolutely
you walked in here today.
Yeah, absolutely did.
But it wasn't, I guess, for it to be a media story.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It was about it being a miracle, doesn't really happen.
I mean, I remember one of the headlines from our local paper, the South London Press, when I went back to my boys' school it was just before I'd left the UK to have the surgery. It said, boys' sci-fi bid to walk. And it was like, and I won't say anything bad against the journalists because they all became friends, and actually we're a very small family of only three, so being part of a larger group of journalists was actually quite handy because it meant that you didn't think about what you were actually there to do.
Yes.
And they became very good friends, some of them still to this day.
Right.
And so I won't, but as you're saying, the media always has to have an angle.
Yes.
You know, and boy goes to get improvement surgery is not nearly as dramatic as, you know, like sci-fi bid to walk, you know. So I do understand why they had to take that. And also, we wanted to raise as much money as we could to give other children in the UK the same opportunity. So, but what was really peculiar about it was also understanding around the same time that I was also gay.
Yes.
So I had this double difference, and that was really, really tricky.
I know you were saying about the boys playing football and you noticing them, and then I guess at one point it would have been jealousy.
Yeah.
And then it sort of moved into something
to begin with.
That was, you know, closer to attraction. I'm wondering, was there any frame of reference for someone that had a disability and also were gay?
I'd love to say yes. And actually, I was thinking about this in the cab on the way over here. I know one of your previous guests, who's a bit of a hero of mine, the wonderful, wonderful Rosie Jones.
Yeah.
If I had had somebody like that on my TV screen at that age, I would have been, I almost can't even articulate what it would have meant to me to have an out gay woman who also had my diagnosis.
Yeah.
You know, obviously her disability is different. All of our disabilities are different, but it would have meant the world. I mean, I know that we spoke before we started recording about, you know, she has quite a difficult public-facing role, and she comes up in for a lot of stick, very sadly. But if I had had somebody like her in my orbit, it would have really shown me that this was possible.
Yeah.
That it wasn't going to be easy.
No.
That it wasn't going to be... Yeah, it wasn't going to be something that... Yeah, it just wasn't going to be easy. I don't really need to say more than that.
I think that's the wonderful thing about sort of Rosie's visibility as a person with a disability, but also as a lesbian, is that she has a happy life.
Yeah, she does.
I think that's the thing that... I mean, I can only speak from a sort of queer woman's perspective, but, you know, I didn't feel like I saw a lot of that as a gay person, as someone that had a happy life. So I can only imagine the sort of, you know, the double weight of that.
I had no role models and I had no roadmap. And also coming of age in the beginning of the AIDS crisis, where you read headlines every day of like, I remember one where a vicar, I think, in The Sun said, if my son came out as gay, then I would rather shoot him than have a...
I remember, I've seen it, just
appalling. So, I just didn't know how I was going to navigate it. And I don't come from a particularly religious family, but my grandma was very, very religious. And I remember she used to take me to mass. I write about it quite a lot in the early section of the book. And I remember praying to this God that I wasn't sure I actually believed in even then, but I was like, please, I can be one or the other, but I can't be both, you know. I can be gay or I can be disabled, but I don't know how to be this thing. I just don't know how to do it.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there's also, from what I've read and when I've spoken to people, there's also a massive desexualization of people that have a disability.
We
just pretend that people that are disabled don't want to have sex, which is
absolutely
insane, because, you know, unless obviously there's some people that don't want to have sex, but lots of people do.
Yeah, of course. And that's the point, isn't it? If you don't see someone, it's not about whether you fancy someone or whether you don't, because that's a slightly different conversation. But if you don't see someone as worthy of sexual desire, then you're enormously dehumanising them. You're taking away a part of their essential humanity.
Yes, and so, sort of lessening them to just one thing.
Absolutely.
About them. So there's great parts of the book where you cover your schooling and you talk about, you know, what that existence was like and, you know, how unbelievably unhelpful the mainstream schooling system was, which, I mean, is... It's so cruel that was just normal for teachers not to say, yeah, we can do everything on the ground floor.
Mm.
I don't know what difference it would have made to all the teachers.
It's such a small adjustment as well, isn't it?
Such a small thing to make it. I don't know how these teachers slept at night seeing you trying to get around the school and always being late when they could have done something to...
Was really peculiar.
Yeah.
But what was really more weird for me was that it sounds a horrible thing to say out loud, but I always expected to be bullied in my boys' public school, and I never was. I actually fit in. I was actually really happy there, and I wasn't one of the most popular kids, but I had a gang.
Yeah.
And I had a place.
And there were, like, the young boys that, like, carried your bag
I had friends, and I had a community. But then when I had to leave that school for the reasons you've spoken about, I then went back into special education, and I really, really disagree with segregated education as an idea anyway.
Right.
But I went back into special education, and the place where society told me I belonged was actually the place where I've never been more bullied in my life. Because I was too gay for that environment.
Yeah.
You know, and going back to what you were saying about disability and sexuality, I think I was too confronting for that environment, because as you're saying, we're not encouraged to think, disabled people aren't encouraged to think of ourselves in sexual terms anyway, and we're not supported to explore that.
Yeah.
And so if you've got someone who's so gay, and I was I'm really like super gay, that was a real problem for the environment that I was in.
And do you think that there was an element with those children that were also in the special needs school that you were too much?
Yeah.
Like that you were, because society has gone, you are all the same, so you will be together. Yeah. But you being gay made them yeah. flinch away from you because Absolutely. You didn't want they didn't want to be identified
and
with you.
I don't know whether you feel this as a gay woman. Like, very often labels are helpful,
yes.
but they can also kind of be a bit narrow.
Yes, and restrictive.
Like, you know, there are as many ways to be gay as there are to be, you know, you're Susie.
Yes.
You're not
yes.
just you're not just lesbian.
Yes.
You know, and so labels are really helpful as a shorthand, but actually, you know, they're also really restrictive. But though, I mean, I could have done myself a few favours. Like, I remember my first night at the school, and I'd stolen a dressing gown from my mother's, the back of my mother's wardrobe, because I just loved it. I just loved it. It was this red silk dressing gown with
sort of like a kimono.
Yeah, it was
thing.
Covered in like gold embroidery. It was really out there. I mean, it was kind of this really ugly thing, actually. But and we had a fire alarm in the middle of the night, so I put it on and went to the kind of assembly point. And it was then I realised that actually I would have made less of an impression if I'd gone in full drag.
Yeah.
Because it was like, here I am. And
yeah.
also I'd been the kid on the telly who'd flown to America to get my legs fixed. So there was quite a lot of bad feeling towards me anyway, kind of the idea that I'd somehow rejected my disabled identity
right, yeah.
by trying to be fixed. And then there I was, essentially in drag in the middle of the night. So it wasn't a great start. It really wasn't.
There's sort of sections of the book that you, or sections of your life rather, in the book that you miss. You reached the stage where you decide to come out and you talk to your lovely mum about it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
She's Lovely. Enormously supportive.
Oh, she's just the best. Hi, Mum.
Hi. But once you had decided to come out, or decided to sort of have an ownership of who you were, did you then think, right, well, where are the people like me in this bar that where, you know, because I think that, you know, certainly when you first come out, And I know there'll be younger listeners going, it's not like that anymore, Suze, but I can only talk from my experience. You know, it was very much like boys in tiny shorts dancing yeah. on podiums.
Very much
and
that.
Like, yeah. And
very much that.
And I remember, you know, as a gay woman being there and being like, God, there's only like 10 of us. But I can't imagine what it would be like to be like, there's only me.
Yeah, it's really weird because I've spoken a lot about this with Laura Kay, your previous guest, who's also a lovely friend, wonderful
yes.
friend.
I know, I'm desperately trying to like get her to become my friend, but that's she's
I think
fantastic.
She already considers me
that's
her
good
friend,
that's good
Susie.
If you don't know, Laura wrote Wild Things and Tell Me a Secret. And she was on in the last series. She's a novelist. If you haven't listened to that episode, I highly recommend it. And that's actually, I think, how this connection
yes.
came about
yeah.
because she suggested that I read your book, which of course I did. But sorry, please go ahead.
But I remember talking to her about, you know, my coming out experience. And for many people, not everybody, but for many people, coming out is kind of a moment of real liberation, and like you can breathe out, you've said it to yourself,
yes,
you've acknowledged it to yourself, and the world hasn't ended,
mm-hmm.
and you've gone, oh my, you know, and you go on to find your tribe, and you are more or less embraced by the culture that you see around you. But I kind of knew that it was going to be more difficult for me. I remember having a conversation with my mum. She drove me back to school, and kind of in 2 hours I came out and then had to go back into the closet because obviously I couldn't be out at school.
Yeah.
And she said, obviously, Emmett, you've got to live as fully and as completely as you can. But I will confess to being a bit nervous for you because I want you to find love. I want you to find friends. I want you to find happiness. And I'm not sure. You know, you're going into a world that's very much about physical perfection. And obviously our conversations have moved on a lot. There's a lot more body positivity.
Yes.
There's a lot more talk about diversity. But I kind of knew that the rainbow of inclusion, you know, the rainbow, the rhetoric around the rainbow of gay inclusivity, I knew it was going to be difficult for me to find a place to live in.
Mm.
And actually, the first time I went to a gay bar, which I talk about in the book, was really, really challenging because I was sat down and a man bought me a drink. And when I'm sat down, I look like everyone, you know, I look like everyone else. And he saw my crutches under the table, and he said, his assumption was that I was HIV positive, and he said, how long have you been positive? So, and I didn't want to tell him that I was actually a virgin, so there was no way for me to be positive or negative. So I was like, but I didn't, so I said, you know, I'm not positive, I'm careful, and actually I'm disabled. And he immediately said, you know, essentially said, fuck off home. What are you doing here? You know, why are you wasting my time? And he reminded me that he'd bought me two drinks, and somehow I wasn't worth those two drinks.
And if you're listening, fuck you, Nick. Which I assume isn't your real name, but fuck you, Nick.
Thank you, Susie. I love being in this safe, supportive, inclusive queer space. It's great.
Now, something that you don't really cover in the book, and I wonder if you'd share a little bit with me, is that now you're married, and we don't get to that sort of adult part of your life. You don't talk about becoming a psychotherapist. And so, I don't know whether you're planning on writing memoir too.
No, I'm, well, actually, no. God, no.
It's too much.
Never want to write about myself again. No, I'm trying and failing at the moment to write a novel.
Oh, we all try and fail to write novels, yeah, Emmett. Don't pretend that you're the only one. We're all doing that, love.
Got a novel under the bed. But no, I am married, and it was really important for me to get married. I know that that isn't, you know, that queer people don't have to get married, no, just because we can, and you know, there are lots of different models of being queer, but it was really important for me to do it because I'm very, very aware that I'm going to get the numbers wrong because I'm crap at statistics.
That's
but
all right.
I think in 66 countries around the world, you know, being queer is still criminalised.
Yes, I think that's about right.
And in 12 of those countries, it's a death sentence.
Yes.
It's a death sentence. So I was actually really moved on the day because I thought, I'm going to do this because I have the legal right and the legal protection to do it. So it's very important that I do it because other people can't.
Yeah.
And it was actually a lot more moving to me than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
You know, it was
did you weep?
I did weep. Although Laurel will tell you, I'm a big weeper at kind of everything, really.
So how did you meet your husband?
I met him, like a lot of arts graduates, because I graduated in theatre design from Goldsmiths.
Right, okay.
Like a lot of arts graduates, I had a very spotty employment history.
Sure, we've all been there.
I was at quite a low point working in a call centre. I won't mention for who.
No.
But I was working in a call centre and kind of wondering, oh my God, I wonder where my life's gone.
And how old were you at this point?
I was about 25, 26.
Right, okay. So you hadn't moved into therapy then?
No, I hadn't. I'd been in therapy as a client.
Sure.
But and I was kind of like, I was really having a bad time. And I was like, I do not know what to do, how to. I mean, the people I met there were lovely and it wasn't a bad place.
No, but it wasn't for you.
Wasn't for me. Wasn't what I had dreamed of. And there he was one day, with his feet up on the desk reading a book, and I just thought, he's a reader. We're gonna have something in common. And yeah, he's lovely.
How long have you guys been together now?
17 years.
Wow.
17. We've only been married for about a year and a half.
Oh, it's quite recent. Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you. But we've been together for about 17 years, and he is magic. Really, I don't want to swell his head too much, but I just, you know, when you feel like you've really found the person that's meant to be with you. And one of the lovely things about it that I wasn't expecting at all was that he had two children from a previous relationship. So I'm now a stepdad.
Oh, wow.
And they just bring so much joy and happy. This is where I get, like I said, I'm a big crier. This is where I get a little bit emotional. So I've got these two lovely stepsons who are just, they, you know, they bring me so much joy and happiness, and they're such lovely young men that it's really, you know, it's been a wonderful, wonderful thing.
So the final part of the show, we sort of do a, you know, a phone call to a younger self, or indeed maybe someone's listening and they're relating to a certain part of your story right now, Emmett. If you could reach out, and I guess I'm thinking about that version of Emmett on the train home after, fuck you, Nick, was so horrible to you.
I love that you hate
him. Oh, I hate him. I hate him. You on the way home and now just telling me about your husband who's magic and your stepsons. If you could reach out to them and just give them a few words of encouragement or pop your arm around their shoulder, what would you say?
I would say, it isn't always going to be easy, and you will be challenged by people, and you'll be challenged by your environment, and there will be people that don't agree with who and what you are. But equally, the flip side of that is you will find your tribe, and you will find the people that love you and see you and celebrate you. And once that happens, life can be more wonderful than you ever imagined. So just hold on and you'll find it.
Perfect way to end our conversation. Emmett, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susie. It's been wonderful.
That was the brilliant Emmett. I think you can tell. I just think he's great. I loved his writing. I loved his story. I loved being able to share it. So thank you, Emmett, for coming on the show. Okay, that's pretty much it from me this week. I thought I'd let you know about my tour, in case any of you are still planning on coming. There's only a smallish handful of dates left. I'll run through them quickly in case you're listening and thinking I want to come. I'm going to Coventry, Chorley, I think it's sold out, but maybe call the theatre, Kendal, Southport, Buxton, Basingstoke, Folkestone. Oh, Folkestone sold out. Maybe call the theatre, because sometimes they had released some on the day. Northampton, Aberdeen, Dundee, Newbury, Brighton, again sold out, but maybe give them a call. Bury St Edmunds, and my rescheduled filming of my special is on the 31st of January at the Bloomsbury Theatre in London. Okay, that is all from me this week. I'll be back next week with another brilliant episode. Thank you for listening and take care. Bye-bye.